Good morning, everyone. It'll come to order. Despite the snow, there is a quorum. Although there are a few of our members, I know I have heard Representative Pawlowski and Poppy, at least, that are not able to be here because of the snow. So maybe they'll get here later, but we expect, given everything that happened, there might be a few that couldn't make it, I guess. We have several bills on the agenda today, seven of them. The Dean bill that had earlier been on is not going to be on the agenda. But first, there is a quorum, and I have the minutes of April 12th before us. Representative Carlson moves approval of those minutes. Any questions, additions, changes to the minutes? Seeing none. All in favor of the minutes, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Okay. First up, Representative Miller, House File 3261. I should ask everyone that comes up how much snow they had. I know you had quite a bit out there, Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, I got lucky. It was about 8 to 10 inches, not as bad as others.
All right. And Representative Miller, you know, sometimes people bring treats concerning their bill to the committee, but I suppose that'd be a bad idea in your case. Tell us about your bill concerning wineries.
Yeah, I get that every committee I go to. So, well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, for hearing my bill. This bill has passed through both transportation policy and finance. MnDOT is not objecting to the bill. There is a fiscal note. That's why I'm here. However, there is no cost to the state or the taxpayer. The cost is carried by the business who wishes to install a blue sign on a state highway. HF 3261 addresses a small but growing issue in greater Minnesota. As you can see in the handout that I provided, farm wineries and vineyards are growing. Many of them have small restaurants or wine tasting rooms for the public. However, many of these locations are also off main roadways, oftentimes a mile or two down a gravel road. Now, these wineries are really important to rural Minnesota. They're part of the growing agritourism that we see throughout the state, as well as young people are coming back to the farm because they're able to do things like this. This is a viable way for beginning farmers to get a foothold in agriculture. Matter of fact, our very own representative, Jeremy Munson, has his own vineyard much like this. The problem these businesses face is that they fall between the cracks of existing signage law. They do not qualify for privately owned signs on the highway, and they do not qualify for the blue signs that you see going down the highways. The retail portion of their business, even though they're working year-round in their vineyards and their wineries making the wine, the retail portion of their businesses is typically only open on the weekends or special occasions. Current law requires 6 days a week year-round. My bill allows them to install blue signs if they are open 4 hours a day, 2 days a week, and if they qualify as a farm winery. My intent was to write a bill that is narrow in scope to avoid unintended consequences, but not too narrow. I have one such establishment in my district, and I do not want to write a bill just for them. I worked with the owner of this business, Hinterland Vineyards, with House Research, my local MnDOT engineer, as well as MnDOT here next door. We believe that this bill is the best way to address this problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I stand for questions.
Any questions on House File 3261? Representative Hilsmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Miller, I support your bill as it is. In the Commerce Department, we heard a proposal to eliminate the need for farm wineries to actually be connected to a farm. In the event you see an amendment of such coming to your bill, what is your position? Would you like to keep your bill clean and away from the controversy of eliminating the requirement of farm wineries being connected to farms?
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hellstrom, when you say the word controversy, of course, I'd like to stay away from any controversial thing. If at such time that were to come, I'd look at it. My intent here is really just to address a very small but specific problem in rural Minnesota. I hope it doesn't expand from that and make it difficult. These miners just want to be able to put signs up.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, under number 3, line 1.14, it says staff food services. What exactly does that mean? And I know you're in the industry, so maybe you can expand on that. What I was thinking of is that, you know, for example, a small winery or small business might be staffed by family members. So I don't know exactly what the meaning of that language is.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, what this is really trying to do is, again, have this narrow scope. This is really what farm wineries do, is they have these small places with food establishments. So one of the concerns, believe it or not, this is kind of a simple thing to get a blue sign out, but it's not been simple. It's taken about a year and a half to get to this point. And just in talking with MnDOT, talking with the businesses and that, this is kind of what they do. And so I understand why you're asking about 1.14 continuous staff food service. Yes, oftentimes it is just the owners that are working there. This is just defining it as it actually has food there that people from that people from the community or other places would go to it.
Representative Carlson, I asked the question, and it doesn't screen out a family operation or an owner-operated establishment where there are no other employees.
Representative Miller?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, no, I believe it does not. This is really just with the intent. One of the concerns that MnDOT had with blue signs is proliferation, right? And I respect that. I don't want to just say, well, anyone that wants. One of the things I've done in previous committees is actually, we joke about it, but I sent around bottles of wine and showed a video of this because it's a very real business. I think what we're trying to make sure is that people don't stretch the term business just so that they can get a sign to their farm. So, yes, this does address that.
Mr. Chairman, I have no problem with the bill. I just was curious what that particular line meant or what the impact was. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions for Representative Miller? Representative Miller, you can put up these signs. Is there a rental cost that the business pays to the state for the sign? How much is it?
Mr. Chair, what's required of the business is to pay for the cost of the sign and the installation of it. That's roughly about $900 to $1,100 per sign. And it, let's say that sign gets knocked down or something happens to that sign, the business owner is required for the replacement cost. I believe that it's after every 5 years. Don't hold me to that time period, but I think it's after every 5 years they have to pay for the cost of reinstallation. So there's no rental. They're just paying for the cost of the sign.
And is that the case for the other blue signs we see out there, too? Basically, the cost is that people pay is the cost to put up the sign.
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding, yes.
All right. Okay. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with regard to the statement about the business owner being responsible to replace that, I know I've been the father of some children who have knocked down some signs, and we get a bill from the state of Minnesota to replace that. So I think maybe insurance does cover that.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, any last comments, Representative Miller?
Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair and Committee. I ask for your support.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House Call 3261 be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 3261 is referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up, we have Representative Quam with the Claims Bill. Chair will move that House File 4157 be referred to the General Register, and I think I'll also, looks like now is an appropriate time to move the A18-0733 amendment. Representative Quam, to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What happens is before the committee meets, we have a bill drafted and dropped, and the amendment just represents the actual activity and deltas from the meeting itself.
Okay, why don't I, unless anyone has any other questions on the amendment, why don't we adopt the amendment and then we can have discussion of the bill as amended. See no further discussion. All in favor of the A18-0733 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Quam, if you can talk to us about House File 4157 about as amended. Representative Quam.
Thank you. I'm glad that I'm not being charged to phone a friend. Basically.
Chairman, to that point.
Oh, Representative Davids.
I think I need to phone his phone is off, as witnessed by Chair Hamilton.
Oh, all right.
Who's the provider?
Sounds like you should bring some. Sounds like you should bring something to the Commerce Committee, Representative Davidson.
I think there will be.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And basically, this is the standard claims bill with Department of Corrections. There's exoneration awards this time. And the nice thing is that a couple years ago when we had our first, it was a few million dollars. This, I think, is going to be more representative of the ongoing of the three claims and the approximate size. And it's very well stipulated what the amounts are. There's a judicial and other reviews that happen, and it comes to us with these recommendations per the code. Department of Revenue. In fact, I do have a testifier with me that can go into greater details if there are questions, but I think I'll just let member questions dictate, you know, how far we get into the details.
All right. Are there questions from members to Representative Quam on the claims bill? Doesn't look like there's any questions. Okay, Representative Quam, do you have anything else you want to add?
8 inches and about a quarter inch of freezing rain and sleet. I thought you asked earlier on just what we had gotten. But, no, thank you for hearing the bill.
Okay. All right. See, no further discussion. The chair will renew his motion that House File 4157, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 4157, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Quam. And next, we're here for Representative Albright Day, who has no less than four bills.
Every day.
But before we get into his bills, I have to show off this new black walnut gavel that I have. You'll notice the old gavel is kind of worn, has paint on it, a lot of banging I've probably done over the years, hitting this thing on the wood here. And I bring this up because this gavel was made by Representative Albright's father, and I thought it would be appropriate to use it for the first time on Representative Albright's bill. And Representative Albright's father provided a number of these gavels to committees last week because he had noticed that a lot of the old ones were not in the greatest of shape. And so before we get to your bills, Representative Albright, I wonder if you could just give us a little bit more history of this gavel and how it came about and where it came from.
Thank you, Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to, share a little bit of the love I have for a father. About 9 months ago, we were up at the Capitol, and I was taking my dad around on a tour of the various committees and whatnot. And oddly enough, he noticed the gavels. He's been a wood smith since he was 16, and he started noticing the nature and kind of the condition of those gavels. And about 3 weeks later, he called me up. He said, "Hey, I'm working on a project." I said, "Well, what's that?" He says, "Oh, it's in the shop, and I'm turning some gavels." I said, "Oh, what are you going to do those for?" He says, "Well, I'm going to give them to you." I said, "I don't have a committee chairmanship. I don't need one." He said, "You already made one for me as Speaker Pro Tem." And he said, "No, these are for the chairs of the committees, for the committee's work, because they need a gavel that's worth something." And I said, "Well, okay." And so we went through a kind of a scope and parameter for the project that he was undertaking. And so, Mr. Chair, he actually discovered through in Sterling Township, down in Representative Munson's district, a farmer who had built a barn out of black walnut back in 1910. Now, it stood until about 1980 or so, 1990, and he took it down because he wanted to build a bigger shed. But he kept the beams and the posts, which were solid black walnut. And Mylon Fisher is the farmer's name in Sterling Township, and Dad and he have known each other all their lives. And he said, you know, I got a project, but I need some black walnut for it. And Mylon took him out to the new machine shed, and he said, I think I got something for you. And so he took a couple of the beams home, cut them up, glued them up, and prepared what you see in front of you. It's our understanding that by the size of the tree that Mylon Fisher took down, which his father planted, or actually cultivated, very likely that the tree that was taken down was much older than even the statehood of the Minnesota.
Timber. So that is really an amazing story, you know, to think that we've got black walnut that started growing before the state was a state, and we're really appreciative of Representative Albright's father going through the time and effort to make, I think it's 28 gavels that he made for us. So
he was happy to do it.
Please express, I know I've sent him a thank you letter, but please express the committee's thanks to him again.
I shall.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, you know, I had a conversation, Mr. Chairman, with Representative Hertoff the other day about black walnut. I wonder if you could share part of that conversation in terms of the value of black walnut. I'm listing an entire barn or shed. Probably was worth as much as the farm. But if he'd be willing to yield to tell a little bit about the formula and so on that you use when you're dealing with black walnut, because it is very, very valuable tree.
It is. Representative Hertaus.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Carlson, or Representative Carlson and members. A few decades ago, I used to do tree appraisals for damages, and the Minnesota Nurserymen's Association and affiliated associations have a methodology of valuing trees. And what you do is you take the diameter of the tree at about 4.5 feet above the ground and determine the area, which, you know, basically is pi r squared. You can figure out the diameter by using pi d as the diameter to do that. But anyway, then at that time, and I'm sure the value has probably changed since I've been doing it, you use $10 per square inch. And so if you had, for example, a tree that was 30 inches in diameter, pi r squared, the radius would be 15. 15 squared would be 225 times 3.14. That gives you 675. So times $10, you'd have $6,750 for that tree. And then there are factors based on species. Usually they were broken down into quintiles, 20, 40, 60, 80, 100%. So black walnut being among the most desirable would be 100% value. So Representative Carlson has quite a fortune of black walnut trees in his backyard, and is probably planning on harvesting those as he starts taking distributions in retirement.
Well, I imagine that in 1910, when they built the barn that you're speaking of, black walnut must not have been as valuable as it is now, or they would have never built the barn out of black walnut. But as you're saying, I mean, it must have been an incredibly valuable barn. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, what generated the conversation was that I had a black walnut tree that was in the way of building a deck back in the 1990s, and I had a neighbor that understood the value of black walnut. I didn't. So the neighbor said, how much did the tree fellow that came to cut the tree down so they could build the deck pay you for the tree? And I said, what do you mean? I paid him, and... recognized the value. It wasn't as big as what he's describing, but it was big enough where it had some value, I would guess. But thank you.
All right. Thanks again, Representative Albright, and thank you again to your father. Well, we'll start with the first of the Albright bills, House File 3873. The chair will move that House File 3873 be referred to the General Register. And there is a, sort of a technical amendment to it, the A1 amendment. Representative Albright, maybe you can talk about why the A1 amendment is necessary.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm actually going to have
Yeah, the A1 amendment just it adds $33,000 to the appropriation.
Yes, it recognizes the need for additional compensation based upon an earlier amendment that was brought forward.
Okay. Any discussion of the A1 amendment?
What is this? Hold on, I don't know. What is this
amendment? The A1 amendment takes money out of the workers' compensation fund and increases the appropriation to the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals for judges.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, the 3873 is a bill that came forward by WCAC to provide for retired judges to sit on the administrative court, and we're making appropriation for them to be compensated in a like fashion.
Mr. Representative Garofalo. Chairman, Representative Albright, my apologies. I thought we did this in committee with the judges' stuff, but apparently I'm told we did not, so sorry about that.
Okay. Any other discussion of the A1 amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Ooh, that's got a nice ring to it. Okay, House File 3873 is amended. Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and members, to the point that was very ably described by the Chair, this is a bill that typically is brought forward on an annualized basis to provide for corrections that the Work Comp Council deems necessary in order to adjudicate claims, as well as to provide for the necessary involvement of administrative courts. This is a piece in the valley language, and I would urge your support.
Any discussion to House File 3873? Representative Herkaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, did the judges of the Court of Appeals get gavels too?
Representative Albright.
No, they did not.
Other discussion to House File 3873? See no discussion. The Chair will renew his motion that House File 3873 as amended be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 3873, as amended, is referred to the General Register. House File 3195. The Chair will move that House File 3195 be referred to the General Register. And there is an A1 amendment to this, too, specifying that the $25,000 in the bill is a one-time appropriation. I'll Chair will move the A1 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Albright to House File 3195 is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, 3195 is a bill that recognizes the age and time that we live in with regard to technological improvements across the spectrum. When we're dealing with health, when we're dealing with psychiatry, when we're dealing with dental, when we're dealing with all the practices of a medical or other variety, I think it's important that we recognize that technology has a means of streamlining those capabilities as well as to provide for greater efficiencies not only for the practice of their discipline but also for the patients that they serve. The bill that you have in front of you as now amended affords those disciplines to work across those lines and figure out means by which that they can provide service in a more conducive way, whether it be telehealth, over Skype, or any number of other potentially technologically disruptive varieties that would be afforded an opportunity to provide better care for the patients. I urge your support.
Discussion of House File 3195. Seeing no discussion, the Chair will renew his motion that House File 3195, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 3195, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Next up, we have House File 4193. The chair will move that House File 4193 be referred to the General Register. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 4193 and the follow-on to this 4192 are bills that are necessary to complete the work that was done in the omnibus bill from last session. Due to an oversight in the enabling language that was included in the omnibus bill from last session, the fee structures were not included, and this just accomplishes that which was already approved in the last omnibus bill.
Okay, discussion to House File 4193. And I wonder, because this also deals with House File 4192, I see Doug Berg back there with House Research. Mr. Berg, could you come forward? And Mr. Berg, I'm just wondering if you could just give us a little bit more background on what happened last year on this and why we still have this bill before us this year.
Mr. Chairman, members, the two bills, as Representative Albright mentioned, simply put in the enabling language for a fee increase at each of the two boards, optometry in the case of this bill and social work in the case of the next bill, that were intended to be approved last year. The revenue was in the spreadsheet and was counted as part of the state budget, and all the appropriations attended on that were. At the end of the negotiation period, the House had carried all of the governor's health board language with the exception of fee increases, and the Senate had not carried any of it. At the end of the negotiation, the word was given to the fiscal staff that it was all to be included, including the fees. The word that was given by committee staff to the research department and the attorneys was to put all the health board stuff in, which they interpreted to be the stuff that was in the House bill, not adding the fees. So the bill neglected to have the fees that were intended to be increased. The spreadsheet counted the increase. There just wasn't the authority to collect the fees.
Okay, so the fees have not been collected in the last year, even though the expectation was that they were going to be?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. However, all the other appropriations relative to that were made last year as part of the appropriations bill. So we just have to correct that the fee collection is not occurring.
Okay. Discussion of House File 4193, Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, the social worker fees seem so significantly higher. This one is a small one on this bill, but when you look ahead to the next one, there are big ones, and I'm just, given the fact that social workers are not highly paid, what's the impact of those fee increases?
Mr. Chair, Representative Houseman, the Board of Social Work really restructured their whole fee schedule last year, so there are a number of changes up and down their fee schedule. As I recall, they actually either got lowered or got rid of one fee and some others increased. They did a sort of a general reorganization of their fee structure. The total new revenue would be $363,000 a year at the Board of Social Work. At the Board of Optometry, it's simply an increase on the existing license fee. They didn't restructure. That would raise $43,000 a year. And again, these boards are entirely fee supported by licensees who are licensed through the boards.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Berg's last comments come close to what my question was. How close are they in balance with the actual cost of operating the board? And they're not supposed to be revenue producing, so what happens if more fees are collected than what the actual cost of the operation is? Where does that money go?
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, the health board statute actually speaks to a reserve, which I don't have in front of me, but if I recall, it speaks to a reserve of up to 1 year's operating costs for the collective, now 17 health boards. And while each board, they attempt to match the fees to the cost of licensure on that board, behind the scenes, we operate all the boards financially together, and so there's one administrative unit. periodically each board takes a look at whether their fees are matching what they think the costs are and come in with adjustments. That's what these two adjustments did. But collectively, the boards hold a substantial reserve, and I don't know what it is off the top of my head, but the statute does speak directly to their holding a reserve of something like a year's operating costs.
Thank you.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding some of these itemization of these 10 different fees. If an optometrist is renewing his license, is he paying just the renewal card fee, or is he paying the licensure application, and is there a cumulative fees that are imposed that make this a couple hundred dollars? And lastly, maybe you could expand a little bit exactly what does the emeritus registration entitle that holder of that status? Is he allowed to practice for $10, or is that just a designation on the license?
Well, it looks like we have a new testifier to answer those questions. Sir, could you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Randy Snyder, the Executive Director for the Board of Optometry. To your first question, there are 1,100 optometrists in the state of Minnesota. This is a not-to-exceed amount. The $170 is the annual renewal of license. That is in bulk the essence of our total budget. The $173,000 is made up of license renewal only. Our other categories are very, very small. So we're looking at a not-to-exceed amount. As he mentioned, there is a requirement to have 6 months to 1 year in reserves. We can never overspend statutorily, so we have to keep a little reserve in case we have contested cases. Minnesota Board of Optometry has $43,000 in their entire account. So we have no black walnut trees. We need to raise our fees. So, and I'm sorry, sir, you're, Mr. Chair, the second question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my other question was about item number six, the emeritus registration.
Mr. Chair,
tell me a little bit Representative, more about that, please.
Yeah, the emeritus is not increasing. That is just a privilege to maintain the doctor title. They are not practicing. If they wish to get back into practice, they would go back into a reinstatement. People have worked very hard to obtain that title, and they want to just keep it in retirement.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, would like to echo Representative Carlson's concern about the fees being aligned with the actual cost of administrating the license. We've got 34% of all professions, occupations in the state of Minnesota now require a license in order to go to work in the morning. And I view many of them as a barrier to people having gainful employment. And in particular, my wife informed me, having submitted the required documents and whatnot with regard to one of a few licenses that I hold, that the contractor license is now $600 to renew. And I just can't imagine that it's costing $600 to process paperwork and allow you to continue doing your job. So I intend to look into this for the next session.
Thank you. Mr. Snyder, do you have something else?
Mr. Chair, I would just say that's a very good concern, sir. There are seven members of the board. Five of them are paying their fees, so they take this very seriously, and they really do focus on a budget and an outcome, and this is fees are not easy for anyone to raise. Statutorily, we have to stay in compliance. And Minnesota also is in the lowest 25th percentile when it comes to optometrist licensure, and I can just speak to that actual occupation. The average is $212 a year nationally, and ours is we're asking permission to raise it to $170, so we'll still be in the lowest half, if not quarter. Good question, sir.
Other discussion or questions for the witness? Representative Albright, any comments or further testimony on House File 4193?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 4193 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 4193 is referred to the General Register. And the final Albright bill, House File 4192. chair will move House File 4192 be referred to the General Register. Representative Albright, please describe House File 4192.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 4192, as has been mentioned in previous testimony, correct a technical oversight from the 2017 budget session. The boards understand that this is an unintentional omission at a very busy time at the end of session resulted in a fee increase not ultimately being passed into law. So there is peace and valley with regard to this legislation.
Let's see. I'll recognize Representative Houseman, and then there may be someone that wants to testify on this. So if they do, come forward, but Representative Houseman.
Well, that may answer my question. What occurs to me from the previous speaker who said when the question was asked about the level of fees, he said of that board, a number of those members of that board actually pay the fee. I wonder if the Board of Social Work, you know, when they decided on all these fee increases, was that true there? Are there members of that board who actually pay the fee, and do they seek input from all of the people in the profession who are going to be affected by that? Hundreds of thousands in there that are collected every year, as I understand, as opposed to the other one, which said 48,000. I mean, it's a significant difference from the previous bill.
All right. Well, it looks like we have a testifier that has come forward. Could you please state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Yes, I am Michelle Kramer-Pivot, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Board of Social Work.
All right. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the Board of Social Work actually spent about 3 years vetting this fee increase. We had watched our numbers rise from 2000 to 2017. We saw a 55% increase in our active licensees. We had a 127% increase in applications received per year and our increase of 68% for complaints received per year. And as we watched these numbers grow, we looked at the data and really kind of demonstrated that it might be a necessary reality to increase our fees. The Board of Social Work really has not had a fee increase for 18 years. And, in fact, we were reduced fees twice, once in 2006 and once in 2009. And we were able to sustain for these 18 years with those changes. So the board takes our budgeting and fiscal responsibility to our licensees and applicants very seriously and try to work within that budget as best we can. Even with this proposed fee increase right now, the fees are still lower than they were in the year 2000. So we had vetted this change with all of our associations, about 10 social work associations. We started talking about this publicly in 2014. And then in 2016 and 17, we also vetted it with these associations. At that time, we had no formal opposition to the changes.
Representative Houseman?
Mr. Chair, apparently, I'm hearing this for the first time, but at previous committees, there was at least some indication of opposition from the profession and some of the schools that graduate social workers. And and I know at this level we don't necessarily take testimony anymore, but I don't know if anyone's continuing to track this bill in the audience.
Well, I know that I had gotten a few emails on this too, Representative Houseman, and underneath House rules, we certainly take testimony for and against bills. We're required to take, at least one person in favor and one person against a bill if there are people that wish to speak. And so if there is someone in the audience that wishes to speak against this bill, I would invite them to identify themselves and come forward. Okay, I don't see anyone. I'm wondering, Ms. Kramer-Prevost, can you tell us what is the annual income of the Board of Social Work right now, and what would it be with the new fees, and how much money do you have in your checking account, in your cash balance, say, as of the end of this last year?
Currently, our base budget fiscal year 18 is $1,254,000. Our accumulated balance right now is $47,000, but we do have a projected deficit for FY19 of $300,000. And these increases that we're proposing, again, is like Mr. Snyder's, not to exceed amount, and we are not going up to that not to exceed amount. We're proposing a lesser amount for our fee structure. That monies that we're looking at would be about a $300,000 increase to offset that deficit.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'm interested in learning a little bit about licensure here. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask basically what does the consumer, what does the licensed social worker get in terms of a benefit from the board? And I'll use as an example, we've had testimony in years past from the State Board of Barbering. And one of the things they do is that they inspect the barbershops to make sure that they're clean and safe and whatever goes into the inspection. I have no idea, other than we did have quite a discussion a while back about the number of inspectors. And Representative Gunther may remember the discussion a few years ago about that. So one thing that the consumer gets in the case of, I guess, cosmetology and barbering, just to use that as an example, is that there's some requirements that certain standards be met. So what does the consumer get, and what do the people who are licensed get as a benefit from the board?
Ms. Kramer-Prevo.
Yes. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the question, because the board's mission really is public protection, so in our benefit for our public is really if they see licensed social workers, they have assurance that the persons met our minimum education standards, national examination standards. They have to do supervision and continuing education, so there's some minimum standards they meet ongoing throughout their career. They also have opportunities to file complaints as needed if any services may be in violation or have not met current standards of practice in our profession. So that is the main reason, that's our main focus, is public protection with our licensing. As far as a benefit for social workers, we feel it does give the profession a benefit as well, as because they have a credibility and an identity within the mental health professional and all the professionals with other types of disciplines as well. So that, as far as us as social workers, and obviously one of the bigger benefits for a professional is that reimbursement for services. Many payers require that credential to be reimbursed for their services.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. I have my licensure, even though I've been retired for a number of years as a teacher. And when I was teaching, we would turn in a form to the Department of Education, and then later the State Board of Teaching, as to what courses we were teaching, if we were appropriately certified or licensed. In my case, for example, I could teach social studies full-time, grades 7 through 12 under my licensure, and because I had a business minor, I could teach up to half-time in my minor. And that was monitored each year by the Department of Education and later the State Board of Teaching. So my question is, do you do that kind of monitoring with social workers? And then in the buildings I worked in, we had, which was a separate license, a licensed school social worker, which is a slightly different track than other social workers would have for their licensure. So I guess my question is, when I said what benefit, to what level do you monitor these things? I, years ago, supported the licensure of social workers. That was a debate a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. Because I thought there was a good direction to go to make sure that there was quality. But my question is more the monitoring side of it. And then while I'm at it, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Berg, in answer to my earlier question, talked about the any excess funds going into a reserve. And we got an answer as to what the budget was, but I'd be interested in how much, if anything, you have in reserve currently.
Ms. Kramer-Prevo.
Mr. Chair and Committee Member Carlson, thank you. We do, in our statute, do some monitoring of our social workers. They are obligated to renew their license if they're in practice every 2 years, so every 24 months they renew. At that point, we ask them to provide verification of their continuing education hours they've completed, as well as completing any supervised practice that they may have been required to do. We do require our new licensees to receive supervised practice when they begin their social work profession, and they file those that documentation with the board on a renewal basis. And as far as our funds, let me move my papers around here. Our current accumulated balance for FY18 is $47,000.
Mr. Chairman, that would be $47,000 in your reserve. Is that correct? What you're talking about? Thank you.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question would center around the budget that you stated and the number of people or staff that is performing this service. I'm presuming that besides the board itself, that it is comprised of people that physically issue the licenses. Is that correct?
Ms. Kramer-Prevost.
Mr. Chair and committee member, yes, that is correct. We have 13 full-time equivalent staff, and we have over 15,000 licensees.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you did answer my next question, 15,000 licenses. So if I took that current application fee, the $45, into that $1.2 million, that would suggest there are like 30,000 applicants. So are there additional fees you're collecting in and above the 15,000 renewals?
Ms. Kramer-Prevost.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the application fee is a one-time fee for our licensees. So new licensees pay the application fee. So we probably see about 2,000 applicants a year. People will apply right out of school or if they're changing their license type. And then the bulk, I think, of our monies come from renewal fees because they renew those every 24 months.
Ms. Kramer-Prevost, did you have another question, Representative Hertaus?
I did.
Oh, go ahead. Yep. Go ahead, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So at 15,000 application renewals, then you're processing about 12,000 or 1,200 per month and about 300 per week, roughly. Are the renewals done on an annual basis, or is it based on maybe alphabetically, or do you have a rotating renewal, or is everybody due at one time?
Ms. Kramer-Prevost.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we do it on it's a rolling basis. Licensees renew in their birth month every 2 years. So we process probably 500 to 600 renewals on average a month on that schedule.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe back to my quantity of social workers then. If you're renewing every 2 years, are there renewals every year? So maybe there are 30,000 people practicing?
Ms. Kramer-Prevost.
Mr. Chair and committee members, they renew every 2 years, so nobody renews annually. Our numbers for licensees, we have LSWs, our bachelor's level. We have about 5,600 of them. We have a graduate level master's, which is probably about the same, 5,600, and then we have our clinical license, too. So they're evenly split in thirds, kind of. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I was just trying to determine if you actually process renewals only every other year or whether you do them every year, and some of this is staggered.
Ms. Kramer-Prevost.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we do process we have so many licensees that we put them 2 years out to their birth month, so it might be an even year or an odd year when they renew. So we are processing all the time, every month.
Thank you. Ms. Kramer-Prevost, the 13 people you have on your staff, can you give us a sense of, are most of those then involved in the license renewal process, or how many of them are involved in, say, handling complaints? Mm-hmm. Can you give us a sense of what they do and which mm-hmm. ones are doing what?
Mr. Chair, yes, we have myself as the assistant director, and I supervise our licensing unit. And I have 4 staff that work for me, so we're the biggest part of our staff that we do process renewals. Again, remembering that renewal also means providing documentation of supervision, so we do a lot of a monitoring of supervision to make sure they're meeting those the statutory requirements for that. We have one full-time regulations analyst who does all majority of our complaint work. She has a support staff, probably it's a three-quarter time that helps her do that. And then we have three operations people who will just answer phones, do emails, order supplies, do the payroll, that kind of thing, and then our executive director as well. So majority of the staff, or half of the staff possibly, is working with renewals.
Okay. Any Representative Houseman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apparently at the last committee hearing, or when it was HHS, the St. Thomas and St. Kate's mm-hmm. Schools of Social Work apparently testified and indicated some concern. Has there been any conversation with the board and those schools since that testimony? And then I might just add my second. The reason I'm still confused, unless there's a different cycle, the fees for nurses seem so much lower than these new fees are going to be for social workers. Mm-hmm. And why the difference? Those two professions have maybe some similarities, and maybe even in salary levels, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But why social work would be so much higher than nursing?
Ms. Kramer-Prevost.
Mr. Chair and Committee Member Houseman, yes, we have had conversations with St. Thomas. I think what happened historically is the social work day at the Capitol happened at the same time our bill mm-hmm. became evident. Many people, especially students, were hearing that for the first time. Even though we had thoroughly vetted this for three-plus years with our associations, that information did not trickle out to all of the constituents. Our executive director, Kate Zacher-Pate, did attend the day of the Capitol and spoke to 1,100 licensees, mostly students. They were actually still students, so about 800 and some of those attendees were students. She did a presentation on the facts of the history of the bill and why that we feel that it's appropriate at this time to bring this forward. So we have worked with them. We've also worked closely with the National Association of Social Workers, the Minnesota chapter, and we've come to some consensus on going forward in a collaborative manner and working towards the fee increase and all the other bigger issues within the social work profession as well, which includes wages for social workers.
In comparison to nurses,
my understanding is that there's over 100,000 plus nurses licensed in the state of Minnesota, and just those sheer numbers alone may make a difference on what they pay for renewals. I'm thinking also that, and I'm just anecdotally thinking that most nurses probably make a higher wage than an entry-level social worker.
Any other discussion to the bill? Representative Albright, any other words on the bill?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you for your support.
Right, see no further discussion. The chair will renew his motion that House File 4192 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 4192 is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you.
And Ms. Kramer-Prevost. Final bill on the agenda is House File 3612. Chair will move that House File 3612 be referred to the General Register. And I know there's a couple of amendments. I believe one of them is the author's. Representative Fenton, do you want to describe the bill or take your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll take the amendment. This is the amendment that I worked on with Legal Aid and the Department of Health. So I'll take the A2 amendment.
Okay. Representative Fenton moves the A2 amendment. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So House File 3612 is about compliance with the federal level for the SNAP waiver. So the first paragraph basically requires reviews of the data and that the Commissioner of Deed communicate with the Commissioner of Human Services as to the employment status throughout the state. And then the second part of it is just that as we resubmit every year, that the department, that we make sure that the info is correct. So, again, we're communicating with the Commissioner of Deed as to the numbers for accuracy. If unemployment numbers are really high, then those on the benefits are exempt from the work requirements. So,
okay, it looks to me like the A2 amendment is sort of in the sort of a technical amendment. Is that fair to say, Representative Fenton?
That is fair to say. And as the bill moved through the committee process, there were some questions about the second paragraph. So I offered to work with the legal aid and Department of Health, and this is a result of that.
All right. Discussion to the A2 amendment. Chair will renew his motion that the A2 amendment be adopted. All in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Fenton, any other discussion to the bill?
I think that's the overall gist of it, as I discussed earlier when I was talking, when we were talking about the amendment. So, again, two things. Just the Commissioner of Deed and the Commissioner of Human Services just communicate and review data, and that, again, just accountability on the second portion. Just make sure as we apply for waivers that the information is accurate so that we stay in compliance with the federal government.
All right. And I do want to ask Mr. Marks a question on the fiscal note. I don't think I've ever seen a fiscal note that has a full-time equivalent employee addition of 0.01 employees. Have you ever seen one of those, Mr. Marks?
Mr. Chair, I don't recall that.
So we have a $1,000 cost to the bill and apparently a $100,000 employee because it's a 0.01 cost. Representative Liebling, is this your amendment, the A1 amendment, and do you still wish to offer that with the other amendment that was adopted?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I did ask for this amendment before I saw the author's amendment. It's not. Well, I'm going to withdraw the amendment, but I still do have problems with the what's left and would like to discuss that.
Okay. All right. We won't have the A1 amendment offered then, so we'll go to a discussion to the bill. Representative Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Fenton. I appreciate that you've been working with some of the parties to deal with some of the issues that have come up in other committees, because we did have quite a discussion on this in Health and Human Services Finance. And I'm sure members, if you've read the bill, which is just two paragraphs, it's even though it's a short bill, it's pretty complicated. This isn't a program that the ins and outs of it are not something that I think most members are familiar with. It's, as you probably know, SNAP is a federal program, and we don't, as I understand it, Minnesota money is not going into it. So it's we administer it, but it isn't Minnesota's money that would be saved. Say if more people are terminated from SNAP benefits, the state of Minnesota doesn't save money from that because it's federal money. But the more I read this, Representative Fenton, kind of the more questions I have about it. And I have spent considerable time actually kind of rereading it. So first of all, I just want to ask if I may, I think you just said that the waiver that we apply for it every year, and that was something I wasn't clear about. Maybe you could just confirm that for me. Is it, do we reapply every year for this waiver?
Representative Fenton.
Yes, you have to apply every year. So you have to review the data, and that's, those are federal standards.
Okay, and Representative Mr. Chair, Lee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I read the first paragraph here, it's not clear to me then, maybe you could just from the simple language of this, is this something, this review of employment data, it's intended under the language of the bill that this review in which Deed gets consulted is something that would occur then every year, or is it kind of a once and done?
It's something that should, my apologies, Mr. Chair, it should occur every year. We should be looking at the, reviewing the data every year, because that is when, you know, that they would, there would be exemptions or as, where waivers would need to be requested, and again, that happens once a year.
Okay, and Mr. Chair.
Absolutely.
And so, so here's the real concern I have about the bill. First of all, there was testimony in the Health and Human Services Finance Committee that we are already in compliance with federal law. I mean, we have to comply with federal law. I think we all know that. I think that the agencies try to do that. So the question really becomes, what is this bill doing? And so in the first paragraph, if you're reading the language of the bill, it's saying that that Deed, it's getting Deed involved here. It's normally this would be done, as I understand it, by the Department of Human Services. So what the bill does is get Deed involved in reviewing this employment data, and it says that we would terminate the waiver in regions that no longer meet the requirements that I guess the requirements as revealed by this Deed review of data. And I guess the question that I would have then for Representative Fenton is it intended that this termination would happen in between renewals or could happen in between renewals?
Representative Fenton.
So, okay, let me just back up one second. So in paragraph one, my apologies, that is a one-time check for the current waivers, okay? But paragraph two is where you're checking annually as you submit. So it's, again, a one-time check with, and this is yearly. These numbers are needed for the yearly compliance with the federal government. And, you know, this came up, I talked about currently, and one of the reasons we use the word region, I mean, that was some of the federal government language, but because that, it can be counties, but it's also including our tribal units of government as well. So currently for fiscal year 2018, there are 29 counties that are exempt because the unemployment is so high, as well as 12 reservations. So that they do leave it to the state, to those administering as to how, if they're going to do it by regionally or by county.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, okay, so we've clarified then that the first paragraph is a one-time thing. Mm-hmm. And presumably, since it directs DHS to terminate the waivers in regions that no longer meet the requirement, presumably that if Deed gets involved with DHS, and again, I don't know why you really need Deed to get involved here, because I think the data is available and could be just found, and presumably that's what DHS is doing now. But supposing that the Deed gets involved and says, okay, we're going to terminate these waivers, would that then happen? When would that happen, Representative Fenton?
Representative Fenton.
So it would, the effective date of the bill is following enactment, so upon the signature. My hope would be as they apply for every year, that we are compliant with the federal government.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, this thing's so complicated. I apologize. It really is a complicated bill, and I'm trying to really understand what you're doing here. But I'm just referring to the first paragraph. But okay. let's move on to the second paragraph. So as you've now amended this paragraph, I mean, it did, your amendment did take out, I think, something that was pretty objectionable to a lot of the testifiers, this idea that there had something had to be untenable. But what this second paragraph is doing now is telling, is saying that deed has to get involved in telling DHS whether the employment data is meeting the federal regulations before DHS can apply for a waiver. So it's getting a second agency involved, kind of getting the ticket punched before DHS can apply for the waiver. Is that right? And it's an annual waiver.
So that is okay. Correct. They're just making sure that the info is correct for accountability purposes.
So Mr. Scherer, so here's, I'm kind of now going to kind of move to my concern about all of this. And it is kind of buried in all of this language, and, you know, the bill is here ostensibly to make sure that we're following the law. And as I said at the beginning, I think DHS is already required to follow the law, and there's no evidence that DHS is not following the law. So the effect of this bill, the thrust of the bill, is essentially to put in some more bureaucratic requirements before we can apply for these waivers, getting deed involved, having to kind of get your ticket punched, if you will, or having DHS get its ticket punched, rather than just looking up the data by itself, which I presume it can do and has done. It's got to get its ticket punched. The other piece of this is that, and here's where I have concern about the fiscal note, and I wonder if is somebody here from DHS that could come up? So here's a concern. If this bill, in fact, screens out some waiver, if there's, in fact, some additional, you know, DHS goes to deed and we find out that, no, indeed, you shouldn't be getting the waiver, what that means is that people who are currently getting SNAP will, in regions where there's not this screening for work requirements, are now going to have, DHS is going to have to now do screening in areas that no longer have an exemption. And so my question is, doesn't that additional screening cost money to do? And wouldn't that additional money be reflected in the fiscal note, which it is not, as far as I can see?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. My name is Jennifer Sommerfeld. I am the legislative director for the Department of Human Services. And I don't believe that we have a fiscal note with the cost. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to look at it. I think the fiscal note was from Deed. But I think that's where that came from. And then I was speaking with Representative Fenton. Could you repeat your question about screening for me?
Okay, so Mr. Chair. So the thrust of the bill here is that some regions may have exemptions that, in fact, shouldn't have them because they don't meet requirements. So if, in fact, that comes to pass and some regions no longer have an exemption, doesn't this mean that DHS will incur additional costs screening applicants in those regions?
Ms. Sommerfeld.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the cost would most likely be borne by the counties. They do the work with the applicants. It would not be something that DHS would be responsible for. I do want to clarify, though, that right now we are in compliance, so there are no regions right now that we have waivers for that do not meet the federal standards.
And Representative Liebling, I should mention, I did comment on the what I thought was rather unusual deed fiscal note. There is also a fiscal note in there from Health and Human Services or from Human Services that appears to show a zero cost. Oh, Representative Liebling.
Right, and Mr. Chair, that's exactly my concern.
Okay.
Is the accuracy of that. And I understand if you're assuming that you're in compliance and that none of these waivers would be lost under the bill, then I guess that no additional costs would be incurred. But if, in fact, and so here Representative Fenton wants to pass legislation to make DHS jump through some additional hoops to make sure these waivers are accurate. And if they're not, then somebody, the counties, is going to incur some additional cost. And so as we pass this bill, Mr. Chair, I don't think we have complete information. Now that we're talking about this, was there some discussion, Representative Fenton, about getting a local impact note in the other committees?
For Representative Fenton.
Not to this bill. But, Mr. Chair, I also would like to allow the testifier to say a few more things on behalf of the bill.
Sure. Ms. Sommerfeld?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the department is neutral on this legislation at this point. We would, of course, always prefer not to have additional bureaucratic hoops to jump through, as you said. But when we look at paragraph number one, the way we are interpreting this, there is no process to terminate an existing waiver. So we will simply continue with our normal process of applying for waivers, reviewing unemployment data, and go through the process that way. We will have, obviously, the extra step now of having to consult with DEED to ensure that the data that we are using is accurate. But there will be no waivers terminated from how we are interpreting this prior to when we reapply at the end of September. There simply won't be time between now and then to do that. So from our perspective, while this is not something we feel we need to do, this is not going to be creating a significant amount of extra work for the department. Whether there are fewer waivers or not for counties is something that would potentially occur regardless, because we would not apply for a waiver that we weren't qualified to receive. So as if a waiver drops off, then, of course, a county is going to have additional administrative work managing the program, the employment and training program.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you. And I'm not going to drag this out anymore. I just want to say that what this bill is doing potentially is, first of all, taking food benefits away from people who otherwise qualify. I realize that this is something that the federal government wants to do now, and we had a lot of discussion about this in the Health and Human Services committees. But this bill is moving in the direction of taking people off of SNAP benefits, hungry people being denied food support. That's first of all. And the second thing it does potentially, besides a little extra bureaucratic poop for DHS to jump through, it potentially adds additional costs for counties, although that is not accounted for here. And there was testimony, and it was, I guess, on another bill, but talking about SNAP benefits, the state doesn't save any money by kicking people off. But what the state does by applying these work requirements is incur a lot of bureaucratic cost. And in addition, everybody knows that when we start applying more eligibility screening and more fine looks at people's assets and all that kind of stuff, we're also injecting more opportunity to make mistakes and then have appeals and all that kind of stuff, too. So, frankly, I think this is a bill that we don't need. Whatever it adds in marginal benefit, to me, is far outweighed by the detriment that it injects into the SNAP program. So I would ask members to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Other discussion to the bill? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Fenton, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, this really is about compliance, transparency, and accountability. And with that, thank you for your time.
Okay, seeing no other comments or questions, the Chair will renew his motion that House File 3612, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 3612 is referred to as amended, to the General Register. Representative Carlson. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, before we adjourn and dealing with the last bill as an example, your comments earlier about the $1,000 cost, what are the guidelines that you're operating under currently in terms of what legislation must be referred and go through Ways and Means?
You know, Representative Carlson, I've usually looked at it as $2,000, I think, because that has historically been the constitutional amendment cost, and we'd want to see constitutional amendments. This one came here anyway. I didn't call for it. I thought it was rather unusual that you had a $1,000 .01 full-time employee equivalent cost, and I just thought I should comment on that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, what you just shared was, when we were in the majority, was the same guideline that we operate under, or operated under. And I was just curious if our guidelines had changed or not. It wasn't so much this bill, but as we move forward, what is going to be required to come through Ways and Means. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any other questions on anything? Seeing none, members, we